the way I taught myself, and I apologize in advance, Barnes & Noble, but I would go there and use Barnes & Noble like a library. I would go in, I would look for something specific in a book, I'd, you know, write it down on the journal, whatever it was, and I put the book back. Or I'd go, again, I apologize, Barnes & Noble, there was bent pages for me to go back to that book and, you know, or I would purchase a book, take it home, use it, and then return it, as long as, you know, like it was in good condition, I would try and return it. But literally, I would go to Barnes & Noble and get whatever I could from that. And you know, back then, a lot of books came with CDs. So you would pop the CD in, and you would get extra resources from that book.
The champ is here! The champ is here! The champ is here!
Hey, 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 welcome back. Season 3. Man, I'm excited. Got some special guests coming up. Got some awesome stories coming up. And got some fantastic lessons coming up. Really appreciate everyone joining me along this journey. And without further ado, here we go.
Hello, family. Hope all is well. Want to ask for a quick favor. If you have gained value through this podcast, I ask you, won't you take the time to think about subscribing to the podcast? You can do one or two ways. You can either click the link in the show notes to become a subscriber and supporter of the podcast, or you can go to anchor.fm/codinglife. It would mean the world to me. If you take the time to sponsor the podcast, be a supporter, be a subscriber. I definitely, definitely appreciate you all. And here we go.
Hello, devs. Welcome back for another episode of Coding Life. Man, we are pretty much halfway through the year. It's been speeding by. But today, I got a special guest. I got a good friend, Vaughn Dabney, man. How you doing, brother?
I'm great, man. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, for sure, man. First of all, Vaughn, man, let the people know, man, where are you right now?
I'm currently in Los Angeles, California. The sunny weather, beautiful weather. But yeah, I'm in LA.
For sure. And Vaughn, man, what's your title, man? Let the people know what you do.
My main title is founder and owner of Empty Box Media. I develop mobile applications and software applications and solutions for clients all over the world.
For sure. And so Vaughn, man, I know we met, holy crap. We met like in 2014. Holy, has it been that long?
No, it had to have been before that, because I left Atlanta in 13. So
really,
it had to have been either in 12 or 13 that we met it was at Hippopotamus, I believe.
Holy moly, where does time go? Yeah, man. And so I think I told you this. You were the first person of color that I met who was doing coding.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
You know, so
and
like,
that was astonishing to me.
Right, you know, and it was even more astonishing. Even now, when I tell people what I do, they're like, wait, really? Like you? Like, all right. Yeah. Yeah, it's me. okay, let's start back in 2012. Can't believe it's been that long. That's crazy.
A long time, man.
Jeez. So, okay, in 2012, how long have you been coding and stuff when I met you then?
So 2012, is actually, you know what, Marlon, it might have been longer than that, man, because I feel like I was still either freelancing with different companies, like internally, or
okay,
I don't feel like I had left yet, but
this will give you an idea. I remember you was working on a sound app.
Yeah, Sounder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I've always been working on projects, you know, even if I had jobs or not. Like if I was working for a company, I still have my side projects, which is, I think, one thing we'll touch on later on, the importance of having personal projects. Mm. But, I mean, just the rundown, 2009 is when I got laid off from MySpace. And
I didn't know that. What?
You want me to just start from the beginning?
Yeah.
All right. So you know, I went to DeVry University for electronics engineering, basically working on the microcontrollers and parts inside of small electronics. And my last year, I realized I really did not want to be in some clean room with a white coat and working on these things. Like, even though it was interesting to me, that did not inspire me because I wasn't really creating anything. And so I taught myself how to code basic website stuff, took on a client pro bono, and I had her for the entire year of my senior year in college. And she taught me a lot about communication because she was a horrible communicator. And so I had to figure out ways to figure out what she wanted. Even though she told me one thing, she really wanted something else. And so it really honed in on my communication skills and setting expectations for projects. When I graduated that year in 2006, I moved to Atlanta on my birthday the following year, in January, I moved to Atlanta. 3 months later, I got a job with MySpace. So 2007, I get a job with MySpace. It was Fox Interactive Media, Fim Labs, which was based in like Dunwoody area. And it was a small team of us, about 15 people. And, you know, I worked on the music player for MySpace. I worked on the background images that would show up for new movie premieres that you know, they were doing. And I was also, including Dev, I was also customer support. So on top of me coding, I also had to handle emails that came in. And that also improved my communication and handling customers and clients, basically getting me ready for where I'm at now. And 2009, so 2 years later, they came in and canned our whole office. And luckily we all had our own businesses going on, but basically we got laid off. And 2009 was one of the hardest years of my life, but one of the best years as far as being an entrepreneur. It was one of the hardest years of my entrepreneurial life, but it also was one of the best years of my entrepreneurial life, because although I was barely making ends meet for rent and, you know, cell phone, there were a lot of days where I had to call Sprint and convince them to keep my phone on, because if they did not, they would not get paid. And so there was that. Every day from January to September, I would walk to Starbucks and I would get on Craigslist and I would apply to different gigs. I would try and reach out to people for new client work. I was doing everything possible every day. My car insurance lapsed, so I could not drive my car legally, and it was $500 to reinstate because it had lapsed for so long. I barely had, you know, I was making PB&J, man. Like, that's like, you hear about people talking about that all the time. If you're not comfortable eating PB&J, this life is probably not for you, because that is a staple food that costs like peanuts and it lasts you. I had terrible service. There's a bunch of trees in Dunwoody in that area in Sandy Springs. And so I had terrible service for Wi-Fi and phone. And so what I did was I actually had hotspots around my house. I mean, I had sticky notes around my house to let me know where the best reception was. And so when I would get a call, or I would need to make a call, or if I needed to connect on Wi-Fi, I would make sure that the hotspot was there, or that I was standing near that sticky note and just to be able to connect. But I worked my ass off that year just trying to make something work. And in September, I responded to an ad, and this company actually hired my company, not me as a freelancer, but my company. And although I had to go in every day, it felt good. I was hired through Empty Box Media, And I was there as Empty Box Media, and I helped this company, you know, create amazing products for roughly a year, a little over a year. And then I kind of branched off and worked in Turner Sports. There was a opening in the NCAA sports area. So I worked on the brackets with them for about 6 months for March Madness. And then I left. And then I found a company in a little north up 85, and small company, but huge profits. And I worked there for maybe like 6 months. And that was 2012. And I took a trip to Brazil. I took my 2 weeks. I found a $500 flight to Brazil while on the job. And I took my vacation and went to Brazil for a week. When I came back from Brazil, I realized that I did not belong in an office. I did not belong in a place working for somebody else. And I knew I could better utilize my time. And so I put in my 2 weeks. And that day they pretty much said, you know, like, we're not going to keep you here 2 weeks. Like, we understand, like, you want to go. So it's fine. You can, you know, you can leave today and never come back, basically. And one thing that struck me was the CEO reached out to me, sent me an email. He said, "Hey, Vaughn, I'm really sorry and sad to see you go. Like, it's been a pleasure having you here. But honestly, if I didn't have my family and this business is what I'm doing, I would do the same thing you're doing." He said, "So if you need anything at all, call me, email me, do whatever. I'm here." And that was in, again, that was in 2012. To this day, whenever I visit Atlanta, I try and make sure to have lunch or breakfast with this guy. His name is Frank. And he's been a mentor to me. He's been a friend. And I'm excited to hear, like, he actually stepped away from his company and is looking for something, some personal passion project. Like, he wants to work on something that inspires him. And so he actually told me that news. He's like, "You know, I feel like you would appreciate this, so wish me luck." But that was so important to me, and it was such a boost and catapult for me to, like, get out there. And so 2012 was when I left corporate and walked away from that 9-to-5, 9-to-6 time suck. And since then, I've been working full-time for myself. Definitely not easy. It's terribly difficult to do this. You need discipline, but the trade-off and the payoff are worth it. You know, like, time is so precious, and time is the most valuable thing we have, because you can't get it back. You can get back a dollar, but you cannot get back a second. And so for me, being able to spend time with my sisters, my friends, my mom, being able to take trips and travel, like, all those enriching experiences are not attainable when you work a 50-hour week or a 60-hour week, and all you have is your weekends. And sometimes you don't even have that. So it's like, when people realize how precious time is and they get a taste of that, you never want to go back, man. It's like you feel like a caged animal thinking about being in an office or being somewhere where you have to be there every day from a certain time period. I am more effective in 3 to 4 hours each day than I am or would be for 8 or 9 hours a day in an office. Go ahead.
So let me ask you this. What, and I know the answer, but I'm gonna see if we can kind of come to a similar road here. What in you made you realize that, you know, you didn't want to sit in the office, you know, anymore?
I think what made me realize it was when I was in Brazil, I experienced such freedom. It's part of the culture too, but such freedom in the way people spend their days and such freedom in lifestyle. And I realized that this is what I really wanted. It wasn't to work for somebody. And I've always thought that there's no need for us to be here from 8 to 6, 9 to 6, 9 to 10, like, crazy hours. There's no need for us to do that in the American society, because if I say, "Marlon, you have 4 hours to complete this task, you're going to use up pretty much all 4 hours to complete that task. If I say you have 8 or 9 hours to do it, you're going to use that 8 or 9 hours. And so we're terribly inefficient with time. We don't need to spend 40 hours a week in offices and doing things. And even so, like, let's say we did, we don't need to be in an office. Make people remote. Trust your employees. Make them remote. Save on the overhead. Let them work from home or wherever they want to work. As long as they get the work done, it doesn't matter. But we have a trust issue with employees that they will not get the work done. And it's been proven that when employees are happy and when they're in a space where it seems conducive to work, they get more work done than they would if you force them to be in a confined space. And granted, team building is super important, and that actually helps. But there are ways to meet as a team, not in an office. So I just think that I came to the realization I didn't want to be in a confined space, because I can work on 3 or 4 projects in a day instead of one, and be monotonous with my actions and where I'm at and who I see. Like, I love variety and I love to be stimulated in all senses. And so I can't leave work at 11:30 and go have lunch at some cafe and then meet somebody and like, oh, we have a synergy, let's work together. I would never meet that person because I'd be in an office, you know, answering emails. So it didn't seem efficient and conducive for my lifestyle and my brain. I have a huge amount of ideas and I'm great at execution. I can't do that if I'm working for somebody.
I think that, and everything you just say, I think it just sums up to like self-awareness.
Yes.
Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
It's funny. So everything you just said, I'm literally having a taste of everything, you know, especially like I just made a transition and stuff, you know, with my job. And it's like everything is basically, you can kind of see and feel things bubbling, you know, and it's like, okay, what's happening here? Like, there's a shift happening and I'm not sure what it is, but let's find out. So when you started your journey and you said this is what, 2011, 2012 now?
Yes, 2012.
You know what's really interesting, man? I remember in 2011 when I started the sneaker app, and I had matter of fact, Angela Benton. Remember Angela, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Angela Benton told me you need to learn how to code. So I said, all right, what is this? What is that? You know, like, so I looked it up and it just looked completely overwhelming. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm good. You know, just and that's crazy. And I'd be really curious to know, because you say you did DeVry and everything, but I remember in 2011, it wasn't a lot of resources online like to learn stuff how to code. Like, I remember like looking for a bunch of things, and maybe not a lot of efficient resources, but I remember there was not a lot I could find, of course, like versus now. But I just remember that time period. I'll be interested to know, like, what did you do to continuously teach yourself during that time period?
The secret, man. there was not a lot online. You're absolutely right. There was not the massive tutorial sites that we have. YouTube was not flooded with programming videos. You know, like we didn't have what we have now. And so the way I taught myself, and I apologize in advance, Barnes & Noble, but I would go there and use Barnes & Noble like a library. I would go in, I would look for something specific in a book. I'd, you know, write it down on the journal, whatever it was, and I put the book back. Or I'd go, again, I apologize, Barnes & Noble, there was Bent Pages for me to go back to that book and, you know, or I would purchase a book, take it home, use it, and then return it, as long as, you know, like it was in good condition, I would try and return it. But literally, I would go to Barnes & Noble and get whatever I could from that. And you know, back then a lot of books came with CDs. So you would pop the CD in and you would get extra resources from that book. I was on BitTorrent sites, downloading books. I had an entire folder full of torrent based books that I got on Macromedia Flash and Dreamweaver. And I'm old if I'm saying Macromedia, because it was Macromedia before it was Adobe, guys. Just know that. Adobe acquired Macromedia. So before it was Adobe, it was Macromedia, Macromedia Flash and Dreamweaver. And I think there was one more in the suite. But, I was learning those things through books that I got from torrents, and which is essentially illegal files, guys. For anybody who doesn't know what a torrent is, T-O-R-R-E-N-T, the legal file. And you would have these peer-to-peer networks, and you could download pretty much anything from movies to books to whatever. And I just had a library full of books, man. And I would just go through books made by Linda, books made by O'Reilly. You know, like, you would just consume the information. And it was much more difficult than it is now to find info on whatever you want.
Facts.
So now it's like, man, wealth of information. Google is your friend. You can find and learn anything you want for free. You just have to know how to get that information. And it's out there. Like, you know, like a simple Google search and a few hours of digging, and you have exactly what you need exactly what you want. And so people ask me, Vaughn, is coding hard? Is software hard? It's not about difficulty. It's about how much time you have to invest to learn.
Repetition.
Yep.
Yeah. And I've said it plenty of times up on the podcast, like, where, you know, I get that same question, and I said, in my eyes, there's two lanes with coding when you're learning. There's the syntax, and then there's the believing that you can do it.
Yes.
I think believing that you can do it part, that's the hardest part.
It's the hardest part.
It's the mental part. But man, I would have struggled too if I had to learn from books and stuff. I think it was last year. I went to go pick up one of those, like, coding for dummy books.
Yeah.
I'm like, if this is for dummies, we need to find another version.
The dummy books were either hit or miss. Like, they were really good, or they were like, what? They were just, you know, it was hit or miss. But the dummy, I had a few dummy books as well.
After I picked up them, I didn't never pick up another one. And what's interesting now, I'm starting to, like, I have a computer steelbook. It kind of goes through a lot of the fundamentals and stuff of computer science, and I really understand it. And so I've started to pick up a couple of the books and everything. Now I'm starting to get a little bit more into books because, of course, in like my tenure, I've been spoiled by YouTube videos and tutorials. Yeah. And, you know, and it's very, very, anybody is learning right now, we're just very, very fortunate. You know, I know, I seem like it because, you know, we're struggling still trying to understand the syntax and stuff. And so, but now we're very, very fortunate because, I would have struggled with stuff with books. So all right. So now, man, it's crazy. I didn't know you worked for MySpace. That's interesting. I say, okay, so you're on your journey, you're building projects and stuff. So actually, do you remember what your first project was?
My very first project?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a website for this woman who had a nonprofit. She worked with schools, and I can't remember what the purpose of the nonprofit was, but it was a fairly large site that I built from the ground up. And like, this was before like WordPress had the infrastructure to be a site platform. This was before Squarespace. This was like legit hand coding, HTML, CSS, before JavaScript really took hold as far as being, you know, like a front end and somewhat kind of a back end technology. It was before all that. So this was literally HTML, CSS, and I remember working on navigation and drop down. I remember like literally building that. I don't know if you remember, but you know, when the basic list, you use a list, right? An unordered list for mm-hmm. the navigation, and then you mm-hmm. you style that list with CSS. So mm-hmm. basically every navigation during that time was like a list, and it was just styled. And so I don't know if it's still like that, but yeah, it was a site from the ground up. Had to have been maybe 20, 25 pages, and mostly images and text. But it was intensive, man. I did front end and back end, and the design, like I did everything, man. I splitting images up, like slicing images, and you know, again, before a lot of the web standards were truly enforced and making things like, there was no mobile compatibility when I was doing that. Like nobody was worried about that. It was mostly for blind and deaf people that you had to adhere to those standards. But other than that, there was no compliance and or anything that was enforced. So that was my very first project. Again, pro bono, I did not get paid for that. And I spent a year with her, and it was, again, a nightmare, but she taught me so much by being such a difficult client, and I wasn't getting paid for it. You know, that just amazes me to this day. Like I wasn't getting paid for it, and I stuck with it, and I finished it out, and I was proud of myself for doing that. I dropped her as a client, but I was proud of myself. And I think like a year later, she hit me up like, "Hey, Vaughn, I need your help." I'm like, I can't work with you. You know, like I can't do anything with you. But thank you for considering me. You know, and there was always that constant struggle of rates, right? How to set my rates. And I remember, I'm sure there's going to be people that scoff at this and will not even be able to comprehend, but I remember charging $500 for websites. I remember charging, you know, $1,000 for websites, like just hand coding stuff. Like this is not WordPress template, easy site up, Squarespace stuff. Like this is like hand coding, hours and hours and hours of stuff. And I'm charging peanuts. And I think one of the challenges as a freelancer and entrepreneur is like, how do you set your rate? You know, and after learning and after struggling and after seeing how other people did it, you know, I've found two things that need to happen. Number one is you need to believe in your rate. You need to understand that your time is worth whatever rate you set. If you don't believe, your clients aren't going to believe it, and it's going to be a hard sell. So yeah. First is setting a rate that you think you're worth and figuring out like who your clients are. Because some people say, oh, well, I set my rate too high. This person and that person, they're not going to come on. They're not your clients then. You just need to figure out who your target market is. And then secondly is I try to increase my rate every 6 months. And so with newer clients that come in that second category, that second half of the year or second 6 months, the rate goes up a little bit. And that's how I've been able to, over the years, increase my rate. And even with current clients, people say, oh, well, how do you increase your rate with current clients? Something I read a long time ago was with your current clients, tell them ahead of time, hey, my rate is about to go up, but I want to make sure, you know, I keep you around as a client. I value you. Let your clients know that you value their relationship and you value them. Hopefully you've built up a relationship and rapport with them, and they're not just a, you know, a source of money. But let them know that you value them, that the rate is going to go up. However, for 6 months or the next project, you're going to give them a 10%, 20% discount. And you're going to lock them in at a specific rate. That's another method, right? So you can give them a discount on the next project and then the rate goes up, or you can lock them in at a slightly higher rate, but you lock them in for good, right? So you have to be okay with that as well. If they're a client that constantly gives you work, you're not losing anything by locking them into a rate because they're constantly giving you work. If it's a one-off client, you know, where they might give you one or two more projects, sure, just give them a 20% discount, go up in your rate after that. And, you know, just give them incentive to stick around and to continue being your client. Be creative, you know, be flexible. But that's how I found ways to increase your rate and to put more worth on your value, because we put so much time and energy learning and reading these books and watching videos and creating, and we can't keep our rate the same. Like that's not justice for our mind, and our mind is really what we're getting paid for. So you need to feel like you're being valued at what knowledge worth you possess. And so you know,
for sure. So you just talked about you know, building pretty much web apps. Now, when I met you, I think you already worked on like 3 different iOS apps. And if that's 2012, that's Objective 12. C.
So just to clarify, there was actually a platform that I still use today. It's called Appcelerator Titanium. They just had an acquisition recently, and they're now Axway Titanium, the Axway platform. But Titanium came out in 2011. I jumped on in 2012 and started teaching myself. It's JavaScript based, basically JSON notation. And I taught myself how to code, and you get native apps at the end. It's not web apps like Ionic or PhoneGap. PhoneGap was around as well, and I just found Titanium to be more solid. Yeah, you know, Sencha Touch by I think that was by jQuery. But you had those things, and Titanium was the most solid one. Still to this day, I mean, I know you have React, and people love React, but the support for the API and SDK calls, I just don't see the same as Titanium has. So, you know, that's a preference call, but I still use Titanium to this day. I've built over 40, 50 mobile apps, both for iOS and Android with it. It's a solid platform. And I just started teaching myself, and I built my first app was a location-based app to allow you to find dope places to shoot photography, like to shoot photos. And because I was a photographer too. And so I would want to save the places that I saw, and they didn't necessarily have an address. So I could be up in the hills or up in the mountains, and it would use my latitude and longitude to save that location. So I took a picture, I could name it, and I could share it. And I literally had thousands of people on this app. It was a very basic app. You could save your places, you could share them. But I had thousands of people on this app all over the world. I still have that database dump. I lost the domain name, and I managed to do a database dump before that. And I had thousands of people all over the world, literally, Marlon, all over the world, Australia, China, Japan, Russia, Africa, like literally, I think I had someone in every continent except Antarctica. And People were using this to save their favorite places to go get food. They were saving it for like their homes, their best friend's house, school, whatever.
Oh, this is Airbnb, bro.
Right, I know. It was amazing, and it's still amazing to look at that database dump to this day and see what people were using it for. But that was my very first app. It was called Spot On Location. And again, I lost the domain, but recently I brought that app back under a new name about 2 years ago. So like it's been a journey, man. Like, but I've used Titanium to make that happen. They've been my only platform that I've used to develop apps
That's really interesting. And you said 40 to 50 apps were much under iOS and Android.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Like I know a couple mobile developers, and yeah, I don't even think they're nowhere near that. I mean, granted, some of them have been working like for companies and stuff like that, but you know, may not necessarily have like focus on like side projects and stuff. And so, that's actually a good segue. You mentioned earlier that just how important it is for a developer to have side projects. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. If you have no ambition outside of the work you do to get paid for creating projects for clients, you probably should not be a developer, because when you have personal projects, when you have passion projects and side projects that you're not getting paid for, I think that's the true sign that you're meant to be in whatever field you're in, whether you're a designer, whether you're a coder, whatever it is you do in that industry. If you have side projects that still involve that profession, you're doing it for the love. You're doing it to learn and get better as a person in that industry. And you may have other goals of inspiring people or creating a company of whatever you're working on, right? But you're always sharpening yourself. And if you're just that person who gets paid to do the work, and then when you go home at night, you're not doing anything, you're not building anything, you're not trying to learn, you're not trying to get better, then I feel like, you know, maybe this shouldn't be for you. Because where it shows up is when your client comes to you and they say, hey, we have this complex problem. Can you do it for it? Can you solve it for us? And you're like, sure. You go home and you come up with a solution. Client says, yeah, that works, but that's not what we really want. But because you don't go outside of work and push your mind to the limits, you struggle with coming up with more than one solution. You struggle with coming up with other creative ways to solve a problem, because you have not been tasked to push your mind to the limit and say, hey, there's... Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, there was a lot of static. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's still there. I don't know. I don't know if you're hearing it or not. If you're not hearing, then
I'm not hearing. But
okay, I'll just talk through it.
All right. Is it still going?
Yeah. No, it's fine now.
Okay.
So when you're not tasked to push your mind to the limit and think of more than one solution, you become stagnant. And so you're a one solution or a one trick pony type thing. Whereas the person who is constantly growing their knowledge and pushing themselves to try new things and to work on experimental apps or experimental designs or experimental products, just to see what happens, then you have now added tools to your arsenal. Whereas when that client comes to you, you're like, hey, I figured out a solution for this, but I also have two other ones that you might like. See which one works best for you. And the client says, you know what? I like solution number two. Thank you for the options. And it just, you become more of a well-rounded person. Specifically, if we're talking about coding, you become a more well-rounded developer, because you don't just have this one-track mind. You think laterally as well. And it makes you a better person, because that translates over into life. But it also just makes you a global developer who thinks about creative ways to solve problems and to add to your arsenal and to add to the world. But I've always been told, some of my mentors in the coding world and some of the guys I learned from, you know, like they said, one reason they hired me, so talking about MySpace, they said one reason they hired me was because I was working on other things. I was working on other projects. that I was not getting paid for. And they liked that because it showed initiative and it showed autonomy, you know, and two things that are needed in the coding world.
So. You know, that's really interesting that you say that, that, you know, definitely work on side project because it brings a different aspect of pretty much problem solving.
Yes.
Looking at it from different ways. And I think, man, I'm gonna be honest. I think that's one thing I have to get better at, not necessarily, but working on things that may be outside of my lane. Meaning, I don't know, let's say I've been building restaurant apps. You know, it may be a good idea to start building, you know, music apps or,
right,
you know, grocery shopping apps, you know. And then too, and this is the gift and the curse because I go through this as well, is where I'm doing something and I don't like the particular way this company's doing it. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna build it myself. And, but you don't have time to just go build everything that bothers you.
Right.
But no, that's definitely good feedback. So now you left Atlanta 2013, you said?
Yes.
Okay. And you went straight to LA for then, or LA to
now? I was actually going to go to Brooklyn, New York. And on my way, leaving Atlanta, on my way, I stopped in Maryland, which is where I'm from. Stopped at my mom's house. And I just did some soul searching. I was like, yo, like, I'm not moving to New York. Like, it wasn't the move for me, and it still is not the move, because of the return on investment that you don't get when you're up there. And anyone in New York, listen, I love New York. I love visiting, but living there, it's just not conducive to flourish. And yes, like it's a tough city, and if you make it there, absolutely you can make it anywhere. However, I didn't want to choose to go back to 2009. I already had that tough bout with working for myself and making it work. And, you know, my life hasn't been easy growing up either. So, you know, I've already had that humility. I've already had that, those tough lessons and, you know, tough lessons don't go away, but I was not going to choose to do that again, especially in a city that gets terribly cold. You get a box for an apartment. Like, you know, I was over that struggle. So what I did was I got an apartment in DC, and I love DC. I miss it dearly. I don't miss the cold weather. However, I miss that city. And, you know, like, I had a really nice apartment in a great area of DC, in Northeast DC. And I loved it, man. I stayed there for 2 years, still working for myself. You know, like, that's all it's been since 2012, but it was great, man. Amazing. And then 2015 is when I left and came to LA.
So now when you left, went to LA, are you still working? You still having clients and everything? You know, are you, are you still taking clients and everything when you go to LA?
Absolutely. That's never stopped. So.
Well, okay. Better question. Going to LA, did you have to take on more clients? Because it's
no,
it's expensive out there.
No, I mean, I always have anywhere from like 3 to 4 projects at a time. Mm-hmm. But DC was comparable to what I paid in LA for rent. I paid with everything in DC, I paid around like $2,000, $2,100. Mm-hmm. And here in LA, around the same. Like, my rent was 18, and then with everything, it ended up being like 1,900, 2,000. So around the same, same to pay. And I lived downtown LA with a pool on the roof, great community. I had a studio apartment that I loved, and I had a lot of light. you know, I had everything I needed. So, you know, I didn't need like super luxury, but I was good. So I paid around the same.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So we had a smaller discussion on Instagram. And, you know, we was talking about, you posted some stats from Stack Overflow. Yes. Which I've seen what's crazy is I've seen those stats. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's you're gonna find a lot of answers. Or point you in a way you can find answers and stuff in there. So I've seen this this study. It was crazy. I did a podcast, not on that one particular, but I did a podcast just on what the lack of diversity looks like from the bottom to the top. You know, so like I used to work for Uber, you know, Uber Corporate here in Atlanta, and you know how Uber is like 2.3% African American, 0% African American when it comes to leadership, you know, especially tech leadership.
Yeah.
And so talk about that a little bit. Talk about, you know, your thoughts, your insights and everything when you seen those numbers.
Honestly, when I saw those numbers, I honestly didn't expect them to be so low. I think it was something like 7 or 8% of coders were Black African American. And I mean, all the minorities were like 11% and below. But I just didn't expect it to be so low, being that it's 2019. And I knew when I started, I knew that there were not a lot of coders that looked like me. I already knew that, like peanuts in size. But I just thought that, you know, 12 years later, a decade later, that it would be a little higher, you know, maybe like 20%, which is still low. But I just thought it would be higher. And so that makes me more aware, and that makes me want to become more active in pushing for minorities, specifically Black and Brown people, to endeavor in coding. You know, I think over the last few years, you know, ultimately I want to be a teacher, and in the last few years, I've been thinking about, it's been on my mind to kind of teach coding, to go to schools and teach coding to Black and Brown kids. And I always think to myself, well, man, they're probably learning stuff that I don't even know about. They're probably way ahead of what I know. So, like, you know, is there really a need for me to go there and do that? And so last year, I volunteered through NFTE, the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. And I volunteered through NFTE to go to this school every day for, I think I was going for 3 months. I would go twice a week, sometimes three, for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I would sit in on this class, a NFTE class. All of them, there were teams, and they were creating business plans, and they were creating apps to pitch at the end of the year and, you know, win a small scholarship or a small grant or whatever. And so I went there to teach them the basics of coding. So not necessarily syntax of a language, but more so the structures. So for loops, conditional statements, variables, arrays, objects. And these kids got it so quickly. High school kids, they got it extremely, like, first time around, they know what an object is, and they know how to access properties inside of an object and values inside of an object, right? Like, they got it. And it's that light bulb moment you see when you're teaching somebody something and that the light bulb goes off. I saw that time and time again, and it's one of the best feelings when that happens, especially when you see people who are younger than you when that happens, because you know, I just imparted knowledge that I have over my 35 years and they're 16. I can't wait to see when they're 35. And so doing that, I realized how important it was for me to be present in these schools and teach coding and teach engineering. And the best part for me was there were women in there. There were young women in there who got the principles of coding quicker than some of the guys. And I love that, because you and I both know we need more women in there. I don't even know what the percentage is for women of color in the coding community, because I bet that percentage is smaller. Mm-hmm. Much smaller. So it's, you know, maybe 10% of that 7%, right? So
before you continue, for the people that's listening, I'm gonna go down the stats that he posted. Perfect. Now this is from Stack Overflow. It was 76,000 responses that pretty much responded to the survey, and they went through just like their experience, how long they've been coding, you know, when they started coding, you know, their race, their gender, age, all this sort of thing. So 70% are white or European descendants. Almost 12% are South Asian. Almost 7% is Hispanics or Latinos. Almost 6% is East Asians. Almost 5% are Middle Eastern. 3.6% is Black or African American.
I was way off.
And then 2.3% is multiracial.
Way off. Like I'm giving it more credit than it is. It's 3%. That's crazy to me. That's insane to me. And I know Black people make up 12% of the population, but still, like, it blows my mind that we don't have more, and we need more. We need to push more. And there are programs that are doing that. There are people who are doing that, and I see that. But we just need to. We need to encourage, and we need to talk about coding all the time, because I know for a fact that when people meet you and I, they don't think we're coders.
That's not the first thing they
think about. Like, I can't tell you how many times people have asked me if I'm in entertainment out here in LA. And granted, everybody is out here, but like, I don't come off as a coder. And when I tell them I'm a coder, they're like, really? Like, they become so interested in what I do. And that is so important to basically wear that badge of honor loud, so people know, hey, coders can look like anybody. We're people of color, and we're young men, we're thriving, and we are creating through code, and you can too. It's possible. So I just think that I have not done my part in pushing that message, because I was ignorant to the stats, in which I'm now privy to. But I'm going to do my part in pushing and educating and showing people, maybe bringing people more into like what I do on a day to day, and showing them the actual products that I'm creating, because I don't do that enough. I don't show my work on Instagram like I should, but now I know I need to, because obviously there's a disparity that I thought was much, much lower in numbers, when really that disparity is much higher and the gap is much greater than I expected.
For sure. And I mean, I've experienced it, you know, hand on, and, you know, in tech companies and working with other tech companies, you know, and it's a challenge from top to bottom. It's a challenge you're trying to get in, if you're, it's a challenge if you know a minority, if you're even if you're at the top, you know, one of my good friend is a VP of engineering of a particular company, you know, and so, you know, we have conversations and stuff about, you know, his challenges, and he's a person of color, you know, even at the top. And so it's, I just really think we got a definitely a long way to go. And I think we all can play a part, you know, even if you're not a minority, you know, you definitely can play sometimes even more of a more of a role.
Absolutely. The support because we need that from all of our counterparts. But I mean, basically using privilege as a means of support, because, you know, it's still all about who you know. And until we're in these positions of seniority and in these positions to be decision makers, we need that support system there to reach down and pull us up, and then we can pull each other up. It's a crucial system, and not that we need to necessarily rely outside of our community, but just having that support system there helps. So internally we need to help each other, and externally we need to be able to ask for help and balance out these numbers. Like, this is, it's insane.
Yeah, agreed. For sure agree. Kind of transitioning with what's the goal, man? You think you're gonna stay in LA? You think LA is home now, or you think you're gonna move again?
So LA's home for now. Numbers wise, I've been telling people this, like, this is probably the best place to be in the country right now. You know, the cost of living, if you think about states that have warm weather, have nice weather, you have California, you have Arizona, Texas, Florida. That's it as far as like where decent cities are, but Texas was colder than California this year. So was Arizona. I feel like, California got snow north, but it was negligible. It was like one day. Other than that, the weather's always good. The sun is always shining. You want me to repeat that for the car noise?
No, you're good.
Okay. The weather's always good. The sun is always shining. When people see sunshine, they're happy. When people are happy, they spend money. So there's always time for opportunity and for events and for networking and for growth in a place like that. And so the Bay Area is cool, but it's also cool. It's like 62 degrees all the time. You know, I want an 80 degree day. I want a 90 degree day. And you don't get that anywhere else other than California. Miami is cool, but you also have the crazy hurricanes there. Like, you know, I'm not trying to deal with that either. So for me, Cali is home base right now. You know, I've been considering living abroad as well, and kind of maybe doing some stuff in Europe and Africa, and posting up there for a little bit. But for now, it's home base. I'll always have homes all over the world, because my homes are not tied to locations. They're tied to people. So that's why I'm so fluid with where I'm at, because I can do whatever I do anywhere in the world.
So, you know, speaking of homes, and there's one particular home, I'm not sure if how you're going to be able to do it, that you can't take abroad with you. If you can, it's going to be very interesting or expensive. So I remember I was just scrolling on IG one day, and I came across one of your posts, and I said, what is this? And then I look, and like, I clicked on your page. I was like, I know this is not what I think it is. And then I went to the page, you know, of the actual product, and I said, this is brilliant. And I was like, and I tagged you, and I said, man, just when you think you're catching up to the developers that inspired you. Something like this happens, you know. So, you know, introduce the people, man. What you're working on now?
Sure. So, outside of my day-to-day operation of handling client projects and business, I am currently building a home inside of a delivery truck, and I've been referring to it as the tiny home truck. But essentially, I got a 23, 24 foot delivery truck, similar to what you would see FedEx or UPS people driving around. And in the back, in the cargo area, I have roughly 126 square feet, and I have built a home inside. And I have running water, I have a sink and kitchen, I have a Murphy bed that folds up into the wall, I will have a shower and toilet in, you know, in the bathroom. I just got my toilet actually the other day.
Yeah, so water, that.
Waterless electric toilet. I have cabinets.
Wait, what? Waterless electric toilet?
Yes, a waterless electric toilet. Some people have been comparing it to, I've never seen one, but a diaper genie for adults. But basically, the toilet has a cartridge inside, and the cartridge has a bag. It's a very tough bag inside, and basically you go to the bathroom, and when you flush it, the toilet sucks the bag and pulls it to create as much space inside that area where you went to the bathroom as possible, and then it pushes air to the top of the bag, and while it's doing that, it twists it, so therefore it creates this pocket. Twist it around, and then it sucks the bag down. And so basically, you have a new pocket to go to the bathroom. It's airtight, and it doesn't smell. And once you're done with it, there's about 15 flushes in each cartridge. And once you're done, you basically discard the bag at a dump. Not obviously not a regular trash can, but you discard it at a dump. And so, yes, I could have got a composting toilet or a cartridge toilet where I got to clean it out, and that, I mean, that's a nightmare that people have expressed online, but the composting toilet, you still have to manage that. And, you know, I'm reducing my footprint by a huge number or a large deduction in my footprint by just doing this truck. So my one thing that, where I'm not eco-friendly being the toilet, I'm okay with that. Everything else, like I'm using eco-friendly soap. I use very little water. You know, like I'm using solar power for electricity. I'm harnessing the sun. So, you know, I will have the things that you find in your regular apartment or home. It's just on a smaller scale. I'm a minimalist. I don't have that many clothes. You know, I'll be able to do podcasts in here. I'll have a music closet in here that I can literally plug my DJ equipment up to or plug my guitar jack into the wall and just start playing. Like, I'll have a creative space in here, and I'll be able to cook. I'll be able to watch TV, and I'll have a projector. And, yeah, man, I'll have everything I need. And I've been living in it for the past 4 months. It's been amazing, amazing.
So how did the idea come about? Like, you know, talk about that. Like, it was just, you just seen a FedEx truck one day and just, aha, you know, how did that come about?
So it's interesting because even if you can afford rent, why do that? Because you walk away with nothing. Your return on investment is zero. And let's say you pay $2,000, $3,000 per month for rent. It's like $30,000 a year that you're paying, and you have nothing to show for it. You're not even getting a percentage of the profits from the apartment complex that you rent from. So why do that? And then the next logical step is, okay, well, just buy a home, Bond. Okay, let's take that. I'm in LA. Homes don't go for anything less than like $500,000. I mean, that's you'd be lucky to find that, but You're probably talking, realistically, you're probably talking $750,000 to $1 million for a decent home that you might have to do a little fixing up to. But even that's tough. So I don't have the means or the desire really to go through that process or own a home. You know, the next thing is like, okay, can you do a tiny home, a container home, or, you know, maybe van life? So van life, I love, which is converting a van into a livable space. I love it, but vans are small. I need to stand up. I also need a shower and toilet. I need to be efficient. I don't need those things because I'm, you know, I'm boozy or anything like that. Like, I need to be efficient. And if I have the shower and toilet in here, I can operate normally without making too many decisions. Decision fatigue is a real thing. Mm-hmm. So cutting down on that. Container homes are amazing. I will have one, but I also need land for that. So what's the happy medium, right? What's the happy medium between van life and a container or a tiny home, which you need a trailer and land for? That was the delivery truck. Mm. Delivery trucks are larger than vans, and they're also mobile, so they become my vehicle as well. And so I kind of merge the two. A tiny home with a van, you get a delivery truck, and I can stand up in here, 7 feet high ceilings and 7 feet wide, 18 feet long in the cargo. Like, I can comfortably have 6 or 7 people in here and it'd be okay. Like, there's room for that.
So Vaughn, man, definitely appreciate you coming on. Everyone, if you want to check out more of Vaughn's journey, please check him out on Instagram at Mr. Dabney. That's MrDabney. Vaughn also has a best-selling book. I'm going to tag that in the show notes. And definitely, definitely subscribe to Vaughn's YouTube channel. He is pretty awesome. We talked about it briefly. He's building a home in a tiny truck. So I'm going to put that in the show notes as well. If you don't follow me on Instagram, it's Marlon.Avery on Instagram. Marlon_Avery on Twitter. Co-podcast on Instagram. Co_podcast on Twitter. I really, really appreciate everyone. And until next time, we out.